This week's edition of the little show that we call Blind Like Me. As I always say, if you have a better idea for a name for this show, well, let me know, because that's what I thought of, which may not be original. Anyway, my name is Phil Parr. You probably knew that. And we have a friend of ours that we've made off the Blind Like Me list that we never would have known had we not formed this program, had we not gotten started with this. We've made several friends, and one of our favorites is Linda Justice. How are you?
I'm great.
And you're in Pennsylvania. I forget where you are.
Let's see. Where am I? Oh, I'm sitting down. No, okay, I'm in Willow Grove, Pennsylvania.
Willow Grove. I should know that. Let me start my stopwatch here. Oh, wait a minute. It didn't start.
It stopped your stopwatch? No, start your stopwatch.
Let's see. Oh, no, that's wrong. Let's see. There it is, counting down. We'll assume that we killed about a minute before I did that, right?
Very good. Well,
that's
we'll
very good. All right. Well, Linda Justice, and Linda, you're on the list, and you're of course the wife of John Justice.
That's correct.
And with a name like Justice, he should have been a lawyer.
That's right.
John Justice.
We're very law-abiding people, but that's why I don't work for the feds anymore.
No, the judge, John Justice. See, that would be so good, wouldn't it? But instead, he's a piano player and FedEx. And you work for Home Depot.
The Home Depot.
Which is interesting because I talked last night. I told you I did an interview with the Gassman twins from California. And one of them is doing basically for Marriott Hotels, the same thing you were doing for Home Depot. He does customer service. He finds the hotel closest to where they're going to stay and gives them rates and all kind of things. And he uses JAWS.
Great.
And so they employ, I think he said, 25 blind people.
I'm not surprised. I don't know whether Bill Marriott was losing his sight several years ago. I've never heard any more about his eye condition since. That might have enticed them. Who knows? You know, sometimes it takes that sort of thing to motivate a company or people to do things.
Well, would he be a great interviewer? What?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I tried to contact him once, and they didn't let me get that far in the headquarters. I think they're in Maryland somewhere. But, yeah, that would be great if that's still the case and he's still, you know, running the company. I don't know how old the man is. This is about 10 years ago.
And the other one of those brothers, they're twins, and the other one is starting a pilot program for Disney, and they're going to employ some blind people to do their customer service also. Because they have a half dozen hotels and three theme parks here in the United States and several overseas. So this may be a burgeoning employment opportunity for blind people, you know?
Yes, I've heard about Disney. There's a lady I know. She moved to Florida several years ago, and she also was in the process, as of a few weeks ago, going to be interviewed with the Disney people. I think they've already done their homework in terms of what type of speech software to use and computer stuff to use. And, of course, I think it was JAWS. So, you know, they're ahead of the game in that respect. A lot of times these companies want to do that, but they have to pursue the, you know, the endeavor of going out there and making sure that they have compatible equipment. And that scares some people, but I'm glad to see this happening. I know Marriott had an interest, and I know Disney does too. So let's hope for the best, a bright future for many of us, because some of the customer service jobs have had some difficulty because of the, you know, the changes in the technology. So it goes up and down, you know, it just depends.
Well, so we're missing a bet. What we should do is open a training center for blind people to teach them how to do this and then get them jobs at companies. Someone will do that. Not me, but somebody will. They'll be
there. We go.
The blind online, the blind customer service training center, Lufkin, Texas.
I thought that would be where it would be located.
I guess not. Huh?
Okay, it could happen.
It could happen. All right, let's go back to your young years. Where were you born?
I was born upstate Pennsylvania. Actually, it was only about 17 miles from the southern New York State border, in a small town called Towanda, Pennsylvania. And now it's a ghost town, but when I was growing up, you know, it certainly was booming with a bit of factory type stuff going on, and folks were out there working and doing whatever they could. And I was born in 1953, and I had you know, RLF, you know, and so I was a preemie, and. My parents didn't know that I was blind. The hospital never told them anything. They're small town folks, hard working, you know, didn't have a whole lot, but we made it.
Yeah.
But what happened was here, you know, I was able to come home after I gained some, you know, weight, and I survived it all. And here I'm home in a few months and so forth, and they realize that I'm not responding. My eyes are not, reacting, responding.
Yeah.
I'm not responding in that respect. And I vaguely remember them taking me to all these different, I guess, eye doctors. And I don't know, you know how you always remember little bits and pieces of things that when you're really, really, really young?
Yeah.
And the only thing I remember is these doctors would say to me, how many fingers do I have up? And I thought it was a game. So I'd guess, you know. I'd guess, thinking, hey, I'm supposed to tell them how many fingers I think, you know, they have up.
Yeah.
Raised up. So, and they finally determined, and I guess they confirmed with the hospital, so the child is totally blind. I mean, why didn't they tell my parents? So... back then, people didn't go suing somebody because of stuff like that. You just went on with your life. But my parents took it very well. I do commend them for that.
Well, we don't know that the people at the hospital knew. We're not sure that they may not have known. You know,
that's true. But one of my schoolmates, actually Sylvia, and she has a twin brother. Now, he was not blind. He's fine. But they said if they didn't put her in an incubator, that she would either be blind. If they put her in an incubator, chances were she would be blind, but if they didn't, that she would be, you know, mentally challenged or some other things wouldn't work right. So they already knew, and she was born in February in the same hospital, and I was born in March. But whatever, you know, whatever the case is, that happened a lot of times, I guess, where the hospital just maybe did not know.
Well, did they put you in an incubator?
Yes.
And a lot, of course, we've talked to several people who say that they received too much oxygen in that incubator, that it did something to their eyes.
Damages the optic nerves. Yeah,
does that still happen to babies? I wonder.
No, not so much anymore. In 1953, there were 158 babies alone that ended up with this condition. Pennsylvania.
How do you happen to know that?
I don't know. Somewhere in the statistical realm of hearsay. But
okay. All right.
I've heard it over the years that was the case then. So, obviously, the schools for the blind at that time and prior, particularly all the way up until the 70s, were full of totally blind or partially sighted kids who were reasonably intelligent and didn't have other disabilities or other impairments. As they were able to deal with a lot of the eye conditions later on, those of us who really were able to do a lot with our lives because we didn't have these other impairments along with the blindness were there, and then you could see it falling off because the kids just weren't, or they were mainstreaming into public schools. So it was a lot different. The schools for the blind were full to capacity back in those years.
Now, your parents, you say, took it well, so they let you. Did you have brothers and sisters? Or?
My sister, Trish, is 6 years older than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not, you know, she's fine. She's totally sighted and so forth. So I just had my sister.
So, but they let you run and ramble as a child, basically like they would any other child, or what?
Yes, they did. It was quite interesting. We lived in a rural area, but I also had a huge yard, and I played and ran and fell down like every other kid, and I learned the knocks the hard way. And my mom used to say she never picked up all the knickknacks and things, or things she had on her end tables and all of that, just because I was there and I was blind, because she taught me not to, taught me to deal with these things. She didn't try to cover, you know, where we don't want her to fall, or we don't want this. Hey, they let me rough and tumble like any other kid.
Yeah.
The funniest thing is that they had a pre-nursery school program, or actually a nursery school program for the parents to see what type of schooling the kids could have, because I had to go away to school 200 miles from my home.
Yeah.
Or it was desired that I should. They said I should do that. I mean, they said I could probably go to a public school, but they weren't equipped. And actually, back then, where I lived particularly, they were not.
They weren't, yeah.
So somebody, a representative, had come up from Overbrook School for the Blind in Philadelphia and met with my parents. And next thing you know, my mom took the train and went all the way to Philly, a small-town girl, scared, you know, out of her wits, with me in tow, of course. And we went there, and out of the group, I was the only one that was potty trained.
Out of the group of blind children that came to school at you. That's amazing.
My mom was very proud of that. I don't.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've talked several times about this, but how hard that must have been on your mama to give up her child to the care of others.
Yes.
It must have been. I've thought many times about my poor dear mother that sent, as I had a blind brother that sent her boys both off to a foreign school, and she didn't drive, and they were in, you know, that must have been terribly hard on those parents.
It was hard on the parents and hard on kids. You know,
it was
didn't know what you were going to. I mean, when you're a kid, you're excited at first, but then you're without your parents, and every weekend for a while they would come and pick me up, and so we started carpooling with my friend Sylvia's parents. You know, Sylvia was the one that was born a month before I was, so.
Yeah.
She and I became very, very close and as little kids. And she would, you know, at night she'd wake up crying, and I would try to help her along the way, even when I was really, you know, little in kindergarten. And we're still friends. You know, we don't get together because we don't live close together, you know, near one another. But it was interesting. You know, we just all stuck together. And as time went on, and as the year went on, even, or maybe years went on, we obviously went home less and less. You know, maybe at first it was every other weekend, then every 3 weeks, and eventually once a month, you know, because it was hard to travel back and forth 200 miles, a 400-mile trip, actually, round trip. So, but it was a challenge. It was different.
And so that would be 800 miles in a weekend, wouldn't it? So you have to come up and back. And...
Yep.
Well, and so you started the blind school at age six.
Right around, yeah, about there. Yeah.
And they began. Overbrook is one of the more famous. I've heard of the Overbrook School for the Blind all my life. I didn't exactly know where it was, but it's in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so that's where they sent you. And, of course, immediately they started teaching you shapes and started training you in Braille, the art of reading Braille, right?
Yes, they did. They had kindergarten, and then before first grade, they had an extra grade in between called reading and readiness.
Yeah.
I don't know what we did that whole year. If you want to know the truth, I don't remember.
Well, they taught you to read Braille. That's what's getting you.
Well, I think they must have really worked on that then. But I remember reading a lot more Braille in first grade. But I just, that year's kind of blank in my mind. And they, of course, they discontinued that as time went on. So.
Yeah.
So it looked like I kind of missed it, like I was held back a year when I really wasn't, because they had that extra grade in there.
Well, I failed the second grade, so that I was held back a year. Yes. Well, those wonderful days. They didn't like.
Oh gosh.
They didn't like me much. But anyway, have you maintained? I'm sure you're a Braille reader to this day, right?
Oh yes, yes I am. I read a lot of Braille still. Not as much as I used to, but I like it just to keep up with it, and it's something you never forget. You know, we learned on the old board slates. I don't remember the old board slates. And
a slate that laid on a board that hooked and had little, at the ends, it had little holes it went down in.
Yeah, they just kind of went in there. Yeah, that was it. That was
yeah,
it.
Yeah, and you would move when you finished all four lines, and you would move it down to the next two holes.
Yeah.
And you were ready for the next line, for the next lines.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
And then eventually we just freehanded that, and we just moved it down on your own on the paper. The board wasn't under it anymore.
That's right.
Yeah, we started out on the same thing, writing grade one, plain Braille, ABC Braille. And then I guess they introduced you to grade two and grade two and a half. I don't know how many grades are there at Braille these days. But
grade three, whatever. You're right. Yeah, you worked it through to the point where that's all you ever knew. And in math, before they had the abacus, we used the cube slate.
Now, what was that?
It was like a square. Or I don't know how big they were now anymore, but they had those little cubes with all the numbers going around them, and you'd stick them in the holes, and so you could do, you know, addition, subtraction. The only problem was when the cubes fell, they were all over the place. You know,
I
dropped my cubes and made the greatest sound when they fell. You know?
I never saw one of those.
Yeah, I haven't seen one in so long. It's hard to remember. But yeah, and then of course I was introduced to the abacus by the author of the book who wrote the book on the abacus, Mae Davidow, and she taught me to use the abacus. It was later on; it was about fourth or fifth grade, I think, that she actually personally taught me, and I never looked back until the calculators came.
Now, how many was it, you say the school was full? How many blind people was do you suppose were there?
Oh. I don't, you know, I was thinking about some of these things. I know some people that remember everything. I don't remember, but I know each class had as many as 30-some students, which doesn't seem like a lot, but back then, it was. So you could have all the way up through. You had quite a few kids. And I know our class, even when I graduated in 72, we had 28 or 29 students graduate. So that was a large class for a blind class, you know, school.
That would be 350 students about.
Yeah, maybe it was that many. Yeah, and but you know, you think about things that happened to you in school. The only thing that I realized that I don't know how some of us ever got along, because John brought this to my attention when I was little, and we would play outside. We had a playground, and it was a big area, and you kids were just running around. It's a wonder people didn't get hurt more. You know, we didn't have any guide, or I mean, you just kind of ran around, no canes, no, you didn't care. And I had an accident once, and I never forgot it, obviously, but I was out there. I must have been either in reading and readiness or first grade, and I was running outside, and I ran headlong into a jungle gym, and I busted my front lip and smashed my teeth in. They never fixed my teeth. They did take me to the hospital and get stitches, but I was in pain and everything, and they didn't even act like they cared. Oh, we got so they put stitches in there, and they never did anything about, you know, where I'd smashed my teeth. And I mean, today they would have been all over them, you know. So it's
Of course, today they'd have some supervisor out there to tell you to. But we had the same situation. We just went outside, the old cracky old bitchy house mother sat up here in the window and watched us some. But we'd get over behind the hedge, and you couldn't see us over there, and she couldn't see the whole. She could see a little part of the playground. She could see everything wrong you did.
Yes.
Right in front of the door there, but she couldn't see the whole playground. She couldn't see the merry-go-round, which we went around on. I got hit by a swing one time, knocked down, walked in front of the swing.
Ooh.
I ran into a big square post one time that had a sharp corner on it. Why they would put that there with sharp corners, with blind kids running all around, I do not know. But
yeah.
It was there, and I rode a tricycle into the damn thing, and it busted my head open. And you're like, same thing. They had a couple of stitches, but they didn't act like they really much cared.
No, and you know, you're a little kid, and you know, you want some, you know, you want kind of a mom's care or somebody to hug and say you're going to be all right. And you got tough that way. I'll tell you, you really got tough that way. That was a downside. I mean, it wasn't like that in everything, but I think everything you go through makes you stronger, you know, and. I'm sure they're more attentive today, but it just some of those things that happened were just unreal.
That's what life's all about. Let's take our first little break here and be back with more Blind Like Me in just a minute. information you'll probably never need. Titillating tidbits to make you think on the blind side. Here's Mark Christie.
What do museums, cell phones, and ATMs all have in common? Well, they're all featured in the latest issue of Access World, Technology and People with Visual Impairments. Technology is a driving force in making life more accessible for people who are blind or visually impaired, said Editor-in-Chief Jay Leventhal. Leventhal offers a first-hand report on a digital audio tour provided by New York City's only hands-on science and technology center, the New York Hall of Science. Traditionally, museums have not provided a meaningful experience for blind people. Exhibits are behind glass and descriptions are available only in print. The Hall, one of the first museums to provide its visitors with an audio tour on tape in 1999, digitized its tour last year, giving people who are blind the freedom to explore displays in any order. In the continuing search for accessible cell phones, AFB experts review a top-of-the-line cell phone along with software intended to provide blind and visually impaired people with greater access to cell phone's features. Also discussed in the issue are J.P. Morgan Chase & Company's talking ATMs, or e-ATMs, that enable blind people to receive up-to-date financial information through synthetic speech and perform transactions in private by using headphones. For more information on these new technology devices, visit Access World on the World Wide Web. On the Blind Side, I'm Mark Christie.
On the Blind Side, celebrating the contribution of blind people to societal evolution. Our guest today is Linda Justice from Pennsylvania, and she's married to John Justice, and we've got her at the Overbrook School for the Blind. It's a very famous school for the blind, but come to find out it's just like all the other schools for the blind, isn't it? They institutionalized you. There was very little personal care. There was very little. No one really acted like they much cared about you. Well, there were a few teachers, but most times they didn't have much really sympathy for you, and the fact that you were a little kid and needed coddling, as it were. She told us a story about getting hurt on the playground, and as all of us blind kids did, got hurt. So how long did you graduate from that school?
Overbrook
School?
Yeah, I did.
So you did elementary, middle school, and high school all in the same big building.
Well, yeah, there were several buildings, but basically, sure, you know, the school's changed so much now, but basically, yeah, they had a Lions Hall for the kindergarten, and I forget what grades they went up to. They had different buildings, and of course, they had the main building where you kind of ended up, and even the last year, either your junior or senior year, the girls got to live off campus in a house that the school had there for us to learn how to be independent. And, you know, we cooked our meal, two meals a day.
Really?
Yeah. Didn't burn the place down. Did as little as we had, you know how kids are. We were into our music and things. Well, I got out a lot of that because I was a switchboard operator. Lord, I'd work as much as I could after school and at night, make 75 cents an hour. Hey, I had to work hard now.
But
you know?
That's forward thinking, allowing you students, you blind children, to live in a house. They got much more into that, of course. I left school in 58.
Right.
And you had just started. So they had a house, and they would rotate different girls to live in this house?
Yeah, it was between your junior and senior years they would work it through because it could only house so many. So, you know, they'd have to just allow, I forget how many of us were, nine, maybe 10 or 12 of us, I forget exactly, but that's where we would end up, which was a lot of fun, you know.
Sure.
And
was there a sighted person there with you, or was it?
Yeah, we had a house mother, and she would, and then of course we had the partially sighted kids too. So,
yeah.
But we had a house mother, and she basically supervised and
you would go to the store and buy groceries on your own, or
yeah, she would take a group. You know, we'd have turns. You all had different chores every week, so there'd be two or three girls that would go with her to the grocery store. We were just tagging along. Hey, if you were blind, you couldn't, you know, totally blind, but the partially sighted kids could pitch in a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and get whatever we needed. and then there were different ones that would help in the kitchen. But how much time did you have? You know, you got out of school, you had to do your homework, and now they had people clean the place, so we just maintained getting our meals and doing the dishes and taking care of stuff like that. It was fun, you know.
Well, surely that was it, because at the school now, they had you two or three to a room at the dorm at the Overbrook School, right?
In the beginning, we had those big dorms with about all the girls. You know, you were all in one big open room with beds patterned in a certain way until they eventually did away with that. That, you know, the school got a lot better in the beginning. It was very, very institutionalized. It looked almost like my old man said, gee, it almost looked like a prison or something. You know, all these beds and everybody would, you know, that's how they would do it. And then eventually they had the rooms sectioned off. And
well, as you got older, you got to you also you got in a room.
Yeah, and they upgraded the school. Certainly rebuilt its itself as time went on. We got a new principal in the mid '60s, and he really changed things around for the better in terms of building things, putting new heating in. Really making it a lot nicer for you to live there, and the classrooms were neater and nicer. It was very old, you know, very old, and never really changed things for a long, long time. So, that was a positive thing, too. They changed their curriculum. You know how they used to have general and academic classes? They started having regular classes, and the kids that maybe weren't as capable could then take other courses or classes. They weren't so academically geared for them, but they could do other things. So it wasn't like going to basketry and other things that we used to have to do years and years ago before that. So they really started making it more like a normal type, a school type situation. But, you know, I've always been a progressive person. So I was always out there hoping for change. And I know later in my senior year, I was saying to them, well, what's going to happen when we go to college and everything won't be in Braille anymore? And what's going to happen when, you know, they had us starting to type all of our term papers, or what are not term papers, that's college, but all of our reports or papers or book reports, whatever you had to do, they had us typing them instead of Braille.
Yeah.
Because I used to have sighted teachers read Braille with their eyes.
Well, yeah, that's the way they read Braille.
Yeah.
They'd read it with their eyes and grade your papers.
Yeah, so they started having us type them.
So how did you do in school? Were you a good student? Did you make A's?
Yes.
You were.
I was a good student.
You were. You made those A's played their game and learned their Braille and did what you were supposed to.
Yes, I did. I mean, I wasn't an A student. I was probably, between A and B student. You know, there were certain subjects that I probably, math was not. General math, fine, but after that, algebra and all that, forget it. You know, I didn't like that at all.
And they had home ec for the girls?
Oh, yeah.
And you took that?
Took that,
And did they have piano tuning for the guys?
They had piano tuning more so. Well, they still had it, but there again, that wasn't the main thrust. But, yeah, they still continued that. Myron Ness taught that, and that, the guys had that if they want anybody who wanted to take it. I guess it was primarily guys. They had the woodwork for the guys and the shop and all that. And I mean, yeah, they had all that good stuff. But the main thing we loved, and many of us loved, was of course singing and the choruses. This time of year, with Christmas coming on, it's my favorite time of year. One of my favorite times of year. And we always go to Overbrook Schools for the Blind Christmas concert.
Do you still? Yeah. You still do that?
Yes, we do. John loves it. And they have the handbell choir. We had handbell choir, and I was an alto, of course, in our choir. And then we had a trio, girls' trio, and ensembles and so forth that we were all part, if we wanted to be part of. And I took voice lessons, and music was my favorite thing. I mean, I really didn't play an instrument, but I loved to sing.
It's just amazing how many blind people are somewhat musically inclined. I've often thought maybe we learn a lot of songs and a lot of music because you think about it, 70% of a sighted person's input to their brain comes to them through their eyes.
Yes.
And we don't have that to worry about.
No.
That's not a thing for us. We got nothing coming in unless we touch it or hear it.
Also, listening to radio, what do we have? I mean, if you got stuck there on weekends, you know, you're... Early on, you had to have study hall on Saturday and Sunday. They finally took that away.
Yeah.
They improved. And we were able to go out on pass if we wanted to for a couple of hours on Saturdays and Sundays. And we were supposed to go to church on Sundays, but sometimes we would end up not going to church and going to have coffee and donuts, you know, but they
sure.
didn't know. But the thing of it is, we listened to a lot of radio.
Yes, we did. I did.
Yeah. And, of course, I remember our big thing when we were really young kids, because it was the 60s and 64, when the Beatles came out, that was our thing, you know, or the girls, a lot of us, you know, got together. We would sing our hearts out and play Beatle games and do all kinds, because what else did we have to do, you know?
That's right.
Although I don't even know sighted kids that did that, but, I mean, we lived for radio.
Yeah, and I think that's why there are so many blind people who fell in love with radio, who aspired to be radio announcers or disc jockeys or even. Or,
yes.
You know,
yeah.
And there are so many of those. I run onto those all the time. I did four or five interviews yesterday. The Gassman twins are radio crazy. This John Milam that I did yesterday, so that's a pretty high percentage of blind people. I'm trying to figure out some show to do for blind radio interest for blind people who are interested in radio. I haven't got it worked out yet, but if anyone has any ideas, be sure and let me know. So you listen to the big station in Philadelphia.
Oh, there were tons of them, yeah. Quite a few. And we saw the FM thing come into
yeah.
play, literally. And the progressive rock era, and not that
yeah.
I was into a lot of it. I was kind of mellowed out. But, it's just watching, see what happened, how the stations grew and what they did, and then had our favorite DJs, and we just loved it, you know.
Yeah.
We'd get them to come out and do talks at our assemblies, and stuff like that, and we'd get all excited and love that. So it was, these are the things that we love the most. I mean, many of us. I mean, even if you didn't sing or get in the choir, while you listen to music sometime or other, and you really listen to radio a lot, because the only time you had access to TV is when you were in the dorm afternoons or evenings and until you were supposed to go to bed. So, I mean, it got so bad near the end. We had the radios under the pillows and the yeah. earphones and the whole thing.
I guess,
you know?
there are how much, just as sort of an aside, how much TV do you and John watch?
Not much anymore. I listen to I listen to more than he does. I'll listen to A&E or you know, biographies and the History Channel.
Yeah.
I know a lot of sighted people listen to the same thing, too, so or watch the same thing, too. So
well, sure,
it's not all that bad.
They wouldn't be on if somebody didn't watch them, you know?
I listen to a lot of the news stuff, and then that gets on your nerves after a while, so don't listen to much TV at all anymore, actually. But, but back then, as I say, that's what we did. And so it was really an interesting thing. I was a very active person, as I say. And because when I was able to start working the switchboard, that became my main thing. And then besides doing school, I liked to, we had plays in school. We had a play where you could do plays every year
mm-hmm.
and drama club. And I enjoyed that a lot. One year, my teacher, God bless him, Mr. Kenneman passed away a few years ago. We kind of had this rivalry because we were tired of all the partially sighted kids getting all the opportunities, you know, getting all the chances to do things. And it seemed like whenever they wanted to put something together, they would have all the breaks because it was a lot easier for them to show, you know, them what to do, I suppose, than those of us who were totally blind.
Sure.
And I was on a couple of his plays where he had a mixed bag, but he decided he was going to do this play with nothing but totally blind kids, and he had a director who was partially sighted, or an assistant director, Brenda, help him. And for some reason, we never got it off the ground. Different ones had a hard time navigating the stage and doing all the things we were supposed to do. And I don't know, it just kind of didn't work. So he got so frustrated that we turned it into an old radio show type play. And it turned like a radio show.
Uh-huh.
And it was really great. It turned out great. He had all the old commercials, and he ran speakers through the auditorium because they didn't have a system as they do now. And it worked out great. But, he tried it. And there was a bit of a thing sometimes where it just always seemed like the partially sighted kids had, you know, more opportunities and got more opportunities than we did.
Tell me about this. You've alluded to this a couple of times, and we need to get into it. This switchboard thing that you did, how did that? Where was it? And just tell us about it.
Well, you know, we had actually a lady who's still there today, Lucy Boyle. She must be 82, 83 years old. She still works. She was working there for years, too. She's totally blind, and she would teach the students who are interested or who they felt that were, you know, would be good at this type of thing, how to run the board. I guess, I don't know if it was a PBX system or what. I think PBX came later. But they had a switchboard, and they actually had another board beside it where these buttons would go up, you know, pop up and down according to the way the lights were flashing. It was a whole unique system. I never saw anything like it. Later on, they got rid of that. But, you know, and they had the old cord board in the beginning, but I didn't learn how to use that. By the time I got there, they got rid of that. And so they would teach you how to run the board, and I would work after school and in the evening and then on weekends.
At the switchboard, this is a switchboard for the school for the blind.
Yeah, for the whole school.
Okay.
And she would teach you, you know, every day every so many days a week, you would sit with her and work with her until you got really, you know, mastered it completely. And she was tough.
They allowed students to use the phone. I mean, did students have phones in their rooms?
No. We had a phone in every dorm. And they had to go through us. So if they wanted to make a charge call, we would have to go through the operator and set all that up for them. And they would have to bring the money in to Lucy and Mrs. Boyle the next day, or they'd hear about it. Or, you know, but if you make, we'd have to put through all the collect calls for the kids. They just, you know, the phone was just hooked into the system there.
Okay.
In the school. And they couldn't just use it, you know, make any calls. Now, I never called anybody long distance, but I used to call radio stations when I wasn't busy, you know.
Why not?
Yeah.
But they could call a student could go to the dormitory phone anytime they wanted to use it, or they have to get permission from a supervisor, or
when
what?
I know when we were younger, we had to. I mean, my mom, they used to call me the same time every week, and my house mother would want to be in her room listening, watching TV, so she would say... She would tell me that I had to sit by the phone till they called because she didn't want to have to come and get me. That would have been
so much trouble for the old bat.
Heaven forfend.
Wouldn't want to make her actually get up and have to come and get you. Jesus.
That's right. So, you know, but later on, I don't know. It's just, you know, I want to call my mom and I want to make a collect call, and they'd give me the number and I'd put it through for them. Or if they received calls, then I would send the calls to the dorm.
To the dorm. The phone would ring there, and the house mother would have to go get them.
Then they would have to go get them. You know?
All right. Well, that's good. That's a little more progressive than we had. We had to go over to another building to use the phone, and there was only one. You had to get what's called a phone permit from the supervisor. Who are you going to call, and why are you going to call them, and what do you think you're doing, and you don't need to use the phone, you poor blind schmuck.
Yeah.
It was terrible. I hated it. But this sounds like a little more progressive. I'll tell you what, let's take another break, and we'll get you out of high school and see what you did after you graduated, okay?
Well, I can't tell you everything.
Well, you be thinking about it, and you tell us as much as you can now, because we're kind of nosy people here, too.
Okay.
Right back in just a minute with more Blind Like Me.
Research team certifies Screen Reader Friendly. Now with this week's Blind Site, here's Don Shaw.
If you're kind of surfing around on the internet, kind of looking for something to do, go and visit a website I found out about. It's called Blind World. They say the blindness-related magazine for the blind and visually impaired. Sounds good anyway, doesn't it? Anyway, surf on over and check them out. They have a lot of good blindness news stories. I don't know, different things like guide dog stories. Sometimes when a visually impaired person, they makes the newspaper write-up or some kind of news story, something like that would be on there. They do group their stories into categories. So go and take a look at them and see if you find a category you'd like to read some stories that may be of interest in that category. The website URL, if you want to go and take a look, is www.home.earthlink, earthlink.net/blindworld. I would definitely have to give them a screen reader friendliness rating of a 10. Until next time, I'm Don Shaw. Keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sight.
Back for our third segment of Blind Like Me with Linda Justice, and she told me Saturday, and I believe this, Linda likes to laugh. Linda has a good time in life, and she likes to joke about, she tries to find humor in everything, and that's a wonderful way to get through life, maybe not especially as a blind person. It's a good attitude to have whether you can see or not, you know? And I admire you for it.
Well, thank you.
Now, you graduated school in about, you were born in 53.
72.
72. That's the year I moved to East Texas.
Oh, okay.
Tanya Tucker had just come out with Delta Dawn.
Oh, yeah.
What's that flower
Running
you have
with no clothes on? No. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. See?
Told you I do song parodies. No.
See what I mean? All right. So you graduated high school. What did we do then?
Well, you know, it's always, that was the other thing. What are you going to do when you graduate from school? I was obviously, you know, college bound somewhere, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. I thought I wanted to get into social work. Of course, I really loved radio, but I didn't think that would ever happen. So they said, well, why don't you, you could go to a two-year school and then decide, whatever. Well, we were looking through the guidance counselor and I were looking through different things, and there was a college not too far, about 50 miles from my home upstate, called Keystone Junior College. But it was really a tough school to get in. And I was told that I'd probably, it would be hard for a blind person. No other blind person had ever gone there, and it would be tough to get in. And I was very rebellious in that respect. Oh, yeah, I'll fix you. I'm going to get accepted in that college.
Good
that
for you.
College. And, of course, I did.
Good for you. That's a good attitude.
But then, when I got there, it was quite interesting because there was no mobility instructor per se, and it was in a huge countrywide campus.
But now, had you had some mobility training?
Yes, I had.
Okay.
But I'd never been that adventurous as to what I was going to experience then. I mean, it was totally different. I did the best I could, but you didn't get your books on time. They were on all those old reel-to-reel tapes. You had to try to get readers and. I did pretty well the first couple semesters, but I just, it wasn't what I really wanted to do. I almost failed a class at one point. I think it was I don't know if it's history, well, they didn't call it history there, but class. So I had to take a class after the first of the year when we were supposed to be on, vacation.
Yeah.
And that was, actually, we had a good time doing it. I had to take a West African cultures class, which I really loved to make up for the credits that I had messed up on. But then I really got rebellious. No, I don't. It's not rebellious, but I said, I really want to go into broadcasting. I just really want to do that. And so I transferred mostly all my credits to Williamsport Area Community College in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, and went there because they had a broadcasting course there. And I did four semesters in two because I had transferred so many credits. And I did get my associate degree in broadcasting, and I did get my third class endorsed, which I went to Washington.
Wait a minute. I didn't know this.
Yeah.
You got a third phone.
Yeah, I did.
And you, because back then,
back when you had to work for it.
Wait, you had to have a third phone in order to be left alone at a radio station because you had to sign what they call the log, which is a reading of the transmitter every 3 hours to take readings to make sure the plate voltage and currents were all right and that you were running. the proper amount of power. And the non-directional stations required a third phone ticket. And so you got your third phone.
Yeah, I did get it. But see, when we took the test, they excluded what used to be called Element 9.
I know about Element 9.
You did?
Yeah, sure, sure.
Well, when I went to D.C. and took when I went to the building down there and took my, I went to the FCC building and took my test, and it was on tape, and then they had answer sheets in Braille where you circled the letter you were using, and they excluded Element 9 for the blind. So I never had to take it. I probably would have failed. Actually, I knew a lot of sighted people. There was a girl that worked at a radio station up there that's no longer. And I used to go out and hang out at the station with her, and she put me on the air sometimes. We'd have a ball.
And she failed Element 9.
She failed Element 9, and her dad loved to go down to D.C., so he drove us down there, and she took the test over, and I passed it the first time. That's because I didn't have to take Element 9, see. She's still working. Last I heard, she was music director of some station up there. I don't know.
And so you went through this communication. Did they have a control room set up there, a board and everything for you to learn to operate in cart machines?
Yeah, they had the old cart machines, and I'd have my shows every week, and that's how I got a lot of my albums ripped off, because the instructor let me keep some albums there, because what happened was we had so many ice storms that, and I walked to school every day, and unless I couldn't really make it, somebody had to help me, because, you know, you had to drive, because you just couldn't walk, it was all ice. And I couldn't, I was afraid I'd break my albums. I didn't care if I broke a leg, honey, I'm going to break my albums. And my 4-5. Well, so I had a lot of 45s, but I used, and I had a system. I had all my albums, and I kept a lot of them there, and somebody ripped them off.
That's the way it goes at radio stations. And so, well, I didn't know this about you, that you had a real interest in radio at one time. You wanted to be an announcer person, a broadcaster,
a disc jockey.
Hi, everybody, hear the Beatles on WYT, you know, whatever.
And it never really, the sad part is that it never got off the ground for me. And there's a fellow who still works, I forget the station's call letters, in Williamsport, who is totally blind. His name is Lou Cobb.
Uh-huh.
And he's still there, and he went to Penn State, and then I got to know him. We never actually met, but I used to talk to him a lot because we had a big hurricane and flood situations up there one time, and I kept him awake a lot because he ran the board for hours, almost 24 hours, I think, and stuff like that.
So you were there at the station or just on the phone?
No, on the phone. I would just call because, it was so awful out, you couldn't get out.
Uh-huh.
And I just would keep him company every once in a while, and he said, well, call me back on such and such a time, make sure I'm still, going. But he's still there. He's still at one of the radio stations. It's a lot easier now for him because everything's computerized. Actually, it's a lot better for him now. But he said it's boring, But I do know that he would do the same commercials at the same time every day. But the average listener, I guess, wouldn't. I knew how he did this, how he got through it all. But I never was really fortunate. I came back after graduating, and I went upstate and worked at a small station. And at first, the only thing the guy would the only thing he would ever let me do was when they ran the Yankee baseball games. And I would, I'd run the board for that, do all the contests, and I thought that was a big thing because I was actually on a real station. But the station was all automated. Remember those big 12-inch reels and stuff, the tape they used
to
use?
Well, I probably have 50 of them in my garage.
Yeah, I bet you do.
I do.
And that's what they had, so I couldn't really do, there was really no actual announcer. They had people just do the fillers, I guess you'd call them. I don't know what the technical name was. And, of course, the news and so forth. And I did that for a while. I was trying to find a place to live, and I didn't feel like I was going anywhere. And I left that and went into phone work and things like of that nature and never looked back. And I never really got kicked off into radio the way I wanted to.
You never really got to do enough radio to scratch that itch?
No. It's kind of sad. But so what I did that kind of helped along when I met John, I got into this little bit of production thing, which is kind of amateur, but when he would play in clubs for years, I would put together all his break music. So I made tons and tons of tapes of stuff that I would put together. I had a couple DJ turntables and things, and before CDs,
Yeah.
And all that, and I'd make all these tapes for him that he could play when he was on his 20-minute break.
This is when he went on his 20-minute break, so he'd have music because they didn't have a this was in a restaurant. They didn't have a jukebox, so.
Well, they did, but see, they stick that thing. They, you know, they put that thing on. Somebody's that's all they're going to want to hear.
Yeah.
Or you know, so they would actually unplug the jukebox if they had them, or they would have to put their music on. So it was easier for him. He was all coming from the stage for his whole performance, whether it was him or canned music that filled in when he wasn't on stage. So, and that was my stuff. I was proud of that.
Before we get too far away from this subject, this disc jockey that's in Philadelphia, what's his name?
No, this guy's in Williamsport.
Williamsport. Well, yes. Cobb, Lee, you say, what's his name?
Lou Cobb.
Lou Cobb. Your job is find him and get him in contact with me. I want to interview him.
I will. I know how to get in touch with him because there's a fellow out at Overbrook in fact, John knows who he is, too, because when every other year, Overbrook School for the Blind has a career day. And we usually go out and talk to the students about the types of jobs that we do, and they hooked up with Lou with a phone connection, of course, and he talked about what he does, and of course I wasn't there to hear it, so I said, John, I know that guy, you know, so yeah, we can get you hooked up.
Yeah, find his email address or phone number or something. Let me call him. He would be a good interview. If he's done radio this long and sustained and been in radio that long, then he would. He's been successful at it.
Yeah, he's the only one I know that's been, that long, and especially with today's technology and so
I did radio almost 40 years.
I know you did. I know, and you still could.
I could if anybody would hire me. No, I work for everybody in town. Nobody will hire me. That's why I do the Blind Like Me show.
That's right. So that was a great thing for me. I mean, after that, I just pretty much, I actually got totally into switchboard work, which is something I had always done, whether it was for a private a company or, you know, a small business upstate or whatever, until I moved down here in 80 and started working for the Library for the Blind for a while and different things. And when funding ran out, they had to let you go. So I helped John with his business. Bookings and so forth, and doing a lot of that here, and worked for IRS for a few years seasonally, and when I got furloughed because they moved our, they kind of disbanded the criminal investigations unit at the service center because it really belonged downtown in Philly. So, you know, it's interesting. So a lot of us got either let go or put somewhere else, and because I was seasonal, they never really called me back. And I kind of just hung around doing whatever I could until the Home Depot came along, and I kind of, as you know, pretty much put that job together.
Well, you absolutely put it together. You make a long story short, you went out there and interviewed one day, stumbling through the construction site there and finding your way to their office, and you thought your dog, didn't your dog barf there in the office?
Barf in the trailer, yes.
In the trailer, hurled or whatever, it's a good word. There are several words we could use for that. Anyway, your dog upchucked in the trailer.
Poor Chuck.
Poor Chuck. But they called you anyway. Somebody,
yes, they did.
Somebody saw, this girl's got a lot of spunk and vinegar, and she might be good for us, and she's had some telephone experience. She does have the qualifications, so somebody somewhere decided they'd call you back, and then later on didn't you say that they came and said, somewhere or another we lost your application. They'd thrown it away.
Yeah, that was a common thing back then.
They'd thrown it away. You know they had.
Oh, they had. I've had several people. And as I say, I helped a lot of other blind people throughout the country, particularly Florida, obtain jobs through with Home Depot.
Yeah,
I'm sort of the liaison for the.
But
blind
you did what is sometimes the best thing for blind people. You invented a job for yourself. You created a job. There were jobs there, and you created one. You went and got them to hire you.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That isn't exactly inventing a job, but then again, it is because blind people weren't doing that. Home Depot didn't have any blind people when you went to work for them, did they?
Not really to speak of. There was a girl, a lady out in Shreveport, Louisiana, and she did do the job. She'd been there before I was there, but nobody really knew about it. Each store had its own autonomy, each area, district area, and so forth. So nobody had probably ever knew about it. And in fact, she was not all that well and left a few years after that. So I've been there the longest for sure.
Well, when I finally had worked what my last paid job in here in our town, because there are only four or five stations, and now there are only two owners in town. At that time, there were several. But when I realized that I wasn't going to be able to find another radio job in our little town here, I bought 2 hours a day on a little AM radio station and did a thing called American Classic Country, and I rode that little train for about 12 years.
Oh, neat.
And had a guy, my friend Tom, who runs the board for the Blind Handyman, we eventually started doing a little swap shop in the morning, a little tradio show where people call in and advertise their things. And it got popular enough that the ownership of the station took it away from us because it got too popular.
Oh, yeah.
But we rode that train and sold our own little commercials for from mid-'80s till February of 1997. So that is, I bought a board and a three-stack cart machine and a cart recorder, and I did it from my house.
Oh, that's neat.
So I would go in every day every morning at 10:30. They would turn the radio station over to us. We would broadcast from my home until 3 o'clock that afternoon. I played what I wanted to, played old country music, and just had a wonderful time and made a decent little paycheck. He and I did doing.
Aww.
So that's inventing a little job, and sometimes blind people have to do that.
Yes.
In order to find. You know, what you should have done when you wanted in radio was bought a station.
It would have been a great idea. You know, I some things you regret, but maybe it wasn't meant to be. I don't know.
Radio is a mean, nasty business.
Yeah.
You know who gets jobs in radio? The person that's there when the person before them quits.
Oh, yeah.
The last job I got fired from, which was Kipper here in town, as I was walking out, a guy named Randy Shannon was walking in. And I walked out the front door with my Braille clock in my hand, waiting on my wife to come get me. And he drove up, got out of the car and said, "Hi, Phil, y'all have any openings?" And I said, "Well, we have one. They just fired me."
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Yeah, the nature of the beast, I'm afraid.
And they hired him.
I know.
Anyway.
It's a very strange business, and people are still out there doing it. I guess they just love it or whatever, but, of course, you've got these big companies now, Infinity and
Clear Channel, yeah.
All that. But, yeah, so you know, but I was always an outgoing kick-butt person. You know, I would just, if I wanted to do something, I'd go out there and do it try to make it work, you know, because I believed in it.
We look for blind people who are handling blindness well, and you are, definitely.
Well, thank you. I guess I don't have to look back.
No, don't bother. Look, rats might be... Don't look back, Linda. The rats may be gaining on you. That's the thing. We're out of time. I got to go. We got to let somebody else do whatever they're going to do. And I'm glad to find out about your interest in radio.
Oh, yeah, I enjoy this immensely. This has been a great time, and great to share with you all out there. And you know, we've all done so many neat things. It's really a great opportunity just to say, hey, you're not the only one. You know,
that's
the good
point.
Part of it.
You folks put this Pennsylvania reunion together, and Luann and I'll fly up. Okay.
We shall. Yes, we will do that.
Our guest has been Linda Justice. Thank you much, Linda, and we'll talk with you.
All right.
If you would like to be a guest on the Blind Like Me show, it's blindlikeme@txucom.net. Let us know and we'll get in touch with you. Give us a phone number, all right? Thank you much. I'm Phil Parr. See you next week. Bye-bye.